Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
I'd also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
And welcome to the ATS Mix Show, episode 91. I'm Johnny Anonymous.
And I'm still Dave Rabbit Johninator. You just got back from the MUFON. Where are you going to go now?
I'm going to Disneyland!
Yeah, baby! Screw those athletes. They're not the only ones that can do that commercial, are they, John?
That's right.
But you did go to MUFON. Tell me about it. I mean, I know we've talked about it. You know, I know you met a lot of neat people, but just give me a Reader's Digest of what went on.
Colm Kelleher, George Knapp, Nick Pope, Pat Uskert, Dr. Richard Haynes. That was more than two that you asked for.
No, but, oh, man, I'm so envious of you, John. It really upsets me that I didn't get a chance to go.
And 50% of the people I ran into, Dave, wanted to know where you were at.
Hey, and what was that guy's name that was an ex-Vietnam vet?
Robert Mitchell.
Yeah, he did email me. What a great guy this guy was. I'm really envious that you got a chance to meet this guy, John.
He's a real fun guy. Hey, listen, on this show, of course, you know, we've got our UFO sightings.
Yeah, and you know, surprisingly, the Skeptic Overlord showed up for his own show this time, so we actually have the Skeptic with us.
And we have part one of a interview with the world's renowned physicist, Dr. Michio Kaku.
And you know, I practiced that, you know, John, a half a dozen times and never could get it right. So, members and guests, this is the only interview you're ever going to hear me do that I don't call a person by their first name because I could never get it down pat. I refer to the doctor as the doctor.
And if you don't hear your question asked, Hang on to your hats because there's a part two. So let's get right to it.
All right, John.
This is ATS Mix.
What? Whoa, what am I hearing?
What is this?
From AboveTopSecret.com.
Ah, crap!
Here are your anomalous sightings
from around the world.
This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe with sightings from across Canada. Sweeping our way from the west to east coast, we start this week's adventures in Penticton, B.C., where a resident who gained a familiarity with regularly occurring celestial events while stargazing with family members in the Okanagan Valley. On July 11th at 10:50, this witness observed something extraordinary while looking up at a clear sky over the roof from a back patio. What at first appeared to be a shooting star moved slowly in a continuous progression northward, and when the city lights no longer impeded visibility, it was clear that there were, in fact, three reflective oval objects traveling in diagonal formation at approximately twice the speed of a jet plane. This event lasted all of 20 seconds, followed 25 minutes later by another small light which stopped momentarily, then changed direction, shooting off to the east and immediately out of sight. The observer's husband and son joined her at this point to catch sight of a bright flash of light as though someone had taken a photo. Three more flashes followed in the next 20 minutes, none of which were in the same spot, and in fact, if the flash points were connected, they would form a diamond shape. Finally, around midnight, while making her way back inside, the witness caught sight of three more oval objects in the eastern sky, again traveling south to north, this time in a triangle formation. The next day, at 4:05 a.m. in Medicine Lake, Alberta, while sitting around a campfire, telling a less than riveting story to brother and son, a witness was interrupted by his son and told to look up and spy what seemed to be a very large star low in the western sky moving upwards, its trajectory and speed resembling a space shuttle taking off. The ascent was estimated to take about 1 to 2 minutes before achieving peak height, at which point it began moving directly east in a straight line for another 1 to 2 minutes before disappearing behind some trees, followed by the rising of a thick fog preventing any further sky watching. Lastly, in Caledon, Ontario, at 3:30 p.m. on July 12th, a witness was taking in a light show thanks to a thunderstorm when something huge and luminous blipped up in the sky about 30 degrees upward from the back porch. It started on a smooth path across the sky in a northerly direction, moving downwards at 15-degree angle, dipping below the tree line, and was about 16 kilometers away from the observer roughly 2 kilometers wide. The same witness reported a boomerang craft over Bolton in July of last year. This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe, keeping my eyes to the skies for AboveTopSecret.com.
These are the reported sightings over the United States. This is David C. In Texas, an observer was on his back porch when he noticed something moving across the sky that appeared unusual. The viewer stated, "The colors were spectacular, so I continued to watch it. There was a row of strobing red lights that were very definitely ball-shaped on both sides. The belly had a row of white lights that was in the shape of a V pattern. The exact shape was hard to describe because the strobe was very distracting. When I first noticed it, I thought that it might be a satellite. Then it stopped moving, went backwards, then continued onward at an incredible rate of speed, repeating the same maneuver several times." This is David C. reporting for AboveTopSecret.com.
And now it's time for a different view. This is the Skeptic Overview.
It is the Skeptic Overview, and that means that we've got at least one skeptic on board here, and that would be the Skeptic Overlord. Hello, Bill. How are you?
Hello. How are you?
Good. And on the other end...
I forget his name. Who's that?
Yes, on the other end, still stuck somewhere in Corpus Christi, it's my friend, my cohort in crime, Dave Rabbit. Dave, are you there?
Yes. Still here. Still down here in Hotel Hell. So, yeah, I'm here. Hey, by the way, did you listen to the show at all?
See how you guys...
Because, we soldiered on, which you always tell us to do.
Yeah,
to
get, I know.
I was just curious how you like the way we handled the show.
I should forge ahead because I'm maybe 4 or 5 shows behind. It's tough. I try to listen to them in the background. And what happens is I start doing work and I either miss something and I got to go back and listen to that again.
Right.
Or I stop doing work and keep listening to the show and then nothing gets done. It's one of those stupid things. And so, yeah, I'm maybe 5 shows. I'm probably actually closer to 6. At least 5 and a half
great
shows.
Great on all of them except for last week, Bill.
Yeah, so I've heard.
Well, if the UTU's mean anything, Bill, everybody enjoys your show. They really do. So
yeah,
let's
all
soldier
6
on as a three amigos here, a pseudo three amigos. So I know you can send us an email. We got some great threads to talk about. So what you got?
Yeah, I'm just going to run down some of the top threads and then touch on one that just skyrocketed in flags in only a matter of 8 hours today, since it was posted about that long ago. So we'll just toss that one out for general discussion. But the most popular thread in terms of replies this week is a very interesting one started by Solar Sky. And basically, he's a rather frustrated citizen at this point. 519 replies, 24 flags. The thread is titled, "Stop Raising the Minimum Wage and Stop Whining."
Yes, please stop whining.
Yes, he opens it up. Okay, the minimum wage was raised 12% or 70 cents to now $6.55 an hour, and people are still whining. I'm hearing stories of people who earn minimum wage and raising 6 kids, and I'm frustrated. Minimum wage was not meant for people wanting to raise a family, and people need to think before they start popping out 6 kids. Instead
That's the part
of
I
being
like.
Good in bed, right? Instead of needing to being good in bed, they need to get an education so they can get better wages. And yes, that's essentially the case. We keep hearing how living wage is not a living wage, but the original intent was not to provide income for wage earners in a family situation. So some very excellent points in this thread, a lot of replies, really good member responses, and quite the debate going back and forth. As you can imagine, in this intense period of leading up to the election in the political issues forum where this was started, you have several sides of the debate chiming in, some incredibly passionately, some very logically, and others just incredibly misinformed. But all in all, a very, very entertaining read. Have you guys had a chance to see this one?
Yeah, I actually read a little bit about the thing. This minimum wage thing, I mean, people have been bitching about that forever, I mean, and unfortunately, with the rising cost of everything, I mean, there's no way. I don't know how people even support themselves on minimum wage, Bill.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can understand how a frugal single person in the Midwest and maybe not necessarily a major metropolitan area could eke by on minimum wage. I don't think they'd be able to set enough aside to go to college, maybe a community college. But that's about it. But, you know, as far as a family, and even if both parents are working at the minimum wage and there's children involved, there's just no possible way. And it really wasn't intended to be a supportive wage that way. And I agree with a lot that was mentioned in the opening post. And but then there's a lot of great follow-up from the other side of the equation as well.
Yeah, I
moving
think
right
lot,
along. Oh, go ahead.
Just briefly, I think a lot of the tactics have changed. You said that somebody working on minimum wage probably wouldn't be able to put anything aside to be able to save something for college. Now what they're doing is trying to put something aside and save a little bit so that they can buy gas next week.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the other problem, too, is in a lot of areas, you know, the areas that I mentioned, the Midwest, and once you get outside of metropolitan areas, yeah, a lot of times you got to drive 10, 15 miles to get to your job.
Exactly.
And that eats up, I mean, the round trip eats up more than an hour's worth of wages.
Yep.
So that's a problem right there. And then you have your taxes eating up the another, you know, 4 or 5 hours. And, you know, you're by the time you you get down to it, 2 or 3 hours of the day are yours.
So, yeah.
And really, that is an issue. Well, moving on into the second most popular topic, and this was a internet burn burner topic for
week.
It was all over the Drudge Report and almost every website that talks even a little bit about news. One of our members quickly picked up on it in the Aliens and UFOs forum, even before it got into the news forum. He was listening to the radio. OMFG, it's Jack. OMFG, it's Jack is the member name. We won't pronounce what that acronym means on an FCC.
Please send those UTUs to Bill at the Above Network LLC.
Yeah, the first two words would be, oh my, and then you can figure out what the FG stands for.
Yeah, WTF, guys.
Yeah.
So anyway, he titles the thread, Six Man on the Moon Announces We're Not Alone on Kerrang Radio. And this is interesting, too, because both Mark and I have been on this radio show as well, because they do tend to get into some of these topics. And he opens the thread, yes, I've been listening to Kerrang and about how Edgar Mitchell announced we are not alone in the universe. I've only just caught it, and that's all I've heard so far. So he is literally posting this as the interview was going on, and he posted a link to the live radio show as it was streaming from Kerrang. And then this story just went crazy. He is essentially the sixth person to set foot on the moon, and he is certain. He's since sort of backpedaled a little bit, but not completely. But he is certain that there are aliens, and they have visited this Earth, and NASA and other portions of our government are aware of it and are covering it up. So, yeah, this is sort of the thing that everybody on ATS is saying, yeah, see, I told you so. And finally, we have a rather high-ranking person who's been to space who is starting to say these things. So you can imagine the buzz on ATS and literally any other website that lightly brushes up against alien issues.
Right.
We have from thread author Pocky, again on July 22nd, really popular last week with the UFO stuff, 275 replies, 163 flags. So we had two very highly flagged UFO threads last week. And this one is titled, CNN, Video of UFO Craft Destroying Missile Nuke Flying Through the Sky. And he goes on to post, I saw this on CNN's Larry King 3 nights ago. I'm very pleased to see that somebody posted it on YouTube. I saw this on the CNN website yesterday, but I heard people's comments were being appalled that CNN would have UFO stories of this nature on their front page. So here it is, guys. Give this sucker plenty of hits. I have never seen a video where a UFO was actively destroying an atomic weapon. Well, what it turned out to be is, I believe it was a simulation.
Right.
But we have the story being portrayed by the gentleman in the interview. Who was it in the interview? The funny thing is, I'm looking through the thread for the people who mentioned was on the Larry King panel, but they all tended to rely on what was being shown in the video, and all the videos are taken off of YouTube now. You go to play the video, and it says, we're sorry, this video is no longer available. So as you get into the thread with that many replies, hopefully someone has found more links. And I was just watching this some of these videos a few days ago, and now they're all taken off of YouTube. But we have the second reply to this thread. This testimony of these former Air Force officers is one of the best in ufology, in my humble opinion. And that's from our own, very own, one of the amigos, Mark Allen, also known as Springer.
Dun, dun, dun.
Bum, bum, bum. Yeah, so a lot of great comments on this thread from people who saw this, who saw the interview, and also some supporting information that people discovered online from the incident that was posted to other places. And also, here we have the bottom of the page of replies. Yes, there was apparently an actual video of this event, and that's why we saw the simulation on CNN. But Mark chimes in going, the actual video was confiscated by the CIA, according to the man who shot it. The video of the missile and the UFO, as he says, is a recreation in this news videos that we're seeing here. So two really interesting events this week that became huge on ATS covering aliens and the testimony of people in the military and NASA talking about them.
Don't you find it kind of interesting that Larry King, of all people, like in the past, I don't know, maybe 7 months, in the past 7 months, there seems to be, pardon me, Dave, a buttload of interest by the Larry King crew to have UFO stories on.
You know what?
But
I'm not...
why. But John, you know why. I mean, because all these people are closet believers, and, you know, their ratings shoot through the sky when you think about UFOs or aliens or conspiracies. Goes on mainstream media, you know?
That's exactly what it is. I don't know if Larry King believes in UFOs or not, but he believes in ratings and the money that those ratings make him.
Hell yeah.
And he is a master. His longevity in the medium shows that he is a master of knowing what to talk about and when.
Well, you know, if sex sells, and it actually is the number one Googled, you know, porn and sex is the number one Googled thing on Google, and the second...
You should know, John.
And the second most Googled item is flying saucers and UFOs.
Yeah, so what we need to do is we need to get Mark and I on Larry King talking about sex in UFOs.
There you go.
We have evidence that there's sex going on in UFOs.
In UFOs.
And we'll be on
the next Google, John.
Yeah, there you go. That's the best thing to do. Combine the number one and the number two, and there you go.
And you get three. I know. I'm taking this south. I'll shut up.
So what's next here that was very popular in this week?
Another thing that was really popular and just all over the news is how Obama was, what, he was campaigning to be president of the world? Is that what he was? Is that what he's doing?
Yes, pretty much.
So remember anyone?
Yeah, he's already pretty much acting like he's a president, you know. Let's go to some other countries now.
Yeah, but that was a trip. That was already a trip that previously planned because he's on the whatever that subcommittee crap.
Right, but yeah, but his little sermon in Berlin was pretty much quite the thing. And so Obama in Berlin is the title of the thread by anyone, and in the Decision 2008 forum that received a number of replies. Let me go backtrack here. 232 replies, but only five flags. Not really that much of a highly flagged topic. People tend to flag based on the opening post, but I think the thread turned out to be incredible. He opens with a very simple question. Is this normal for a president candidate to make a stump-like speech in another country? I'm watching MSNBC right now in awe. What do you think? And there's lots of people that chime in with what they think. And
sure.
A very interesting thread. We have a lot of the devout Obama supporters, a lot of the devout Obama haters, and everything else in between. If anything, we're going to have a very, very interesting election season, and this is literally sort of this is almost as if it's opening election season. It's opening opening day election season has been posted on the tree just like it's hunting season.
And yeah. Cheney's got a gun.
And Cheney's
well,
got
you know,
a gun.
Well, you know, I mean, I did not see the Berlin. I don't know if either of you did, but I saw the one where he did the joint thing with President Huffois of France. And I'm not, you know, I could give a rat's ass about, you know, Obama or McCain right now. I mean, I'm kind of one of those that, you know, would like to pull none of the above. But that
we
said,
have the thread for you.
You know,
yeah,
from a neutral
that was a teaser.
From a neutral Dave standpoint, they tried sucking him in to make some comments. The press did there, and I thought he handled it real well, saying, you know, he was not, you know. You know, he didn't want to answer as a presidential candidate to a degree, but, you know, he would give him his opinion, blah, blah, if, in fact, he became president. But they tried tricking him two or three times. I thought he handled it pretty well, but I did not see what he did in Berlin. So maybe you guys can enlighten me real quick.
I didn't watch Berlin. I heard most of it. And
so what did he say that was...
Well, first of all, as what you're alluding to, there's no doubt he is a very intelligent guy who is a master at thinking on his feet and quickly giving a rolling back, like you said, and giving the appropriate response and wording it well on the fly. It's been a long time since we've had anybody in any high-level political position who demonstrated that ability to think on his feet so well, which is refreshing. But on the other hand, there's something about the tempo and the style and the very subtle condescending tone, almost as if he, I don't want to go quite to the point where he's sermonizing, but that is sort of the tempo and the flair behind the inflection in his voice when he's speaking. And so when you take that style of public speech and apply it to someone who's speaking about the United States taking a larger role in the world and embracing, doing a better job of embracing immigrants and those that are less fortunate, it doesn't feel like a political speech. It feels more like a sermon.
Yeah.
And that's where I like a lot of his positions, but there's a vibe there that feels like something's not right, really, is the best description I can come up with. What I wanted to throw out for discussion, and hopefully you guys have had a little bit of a chance to at least read the opening post, and I saw this rise in popularity today, and the reason I wanted to talk about it was because you had a chance to interview one of my favorite people in the whole world, Jesse Ventura. And I had seen how he, in an interview, I don't know if you guys touched on this at all. I don't think you did, no. How he had an interview on, it would have been possibly MSNBC, where he was talking about this, about what this member is saying. And it's a thread that doesn't have too many replies. It's still on the second page, but 40 Flags in 8 Hours, authored by Mr. Old School, just posted today. The title of the thread is "I Abstain in 2008, the Second American Revolution." And I'll read a little bit of the thread here. He says, "The time has come for all patriots to revive the spirit of liberty and make clear the mandate of the people. We no longer accept the insult this nation has become toward those who birthed the first revolution. And for the first time in history, another revolution is not only possible, but winnable." And he later goes on to say, "In 2008, our call to arms carries no anticipation of violence, no blood, no siege, and no brutality. For today, the field of play for this revolution is not level. For the first time in all history, it is tipped in the favor of the people. Our weapon of the second revolution is the internet and the media." And basically what he's proposing here is that as many people as possible who want to join in on this revolution, make sure that they're registered voters, go to the polls for the national election, but cast no votes for national candidates and vote for local candidates. That way they'll still show up as going to the polls, but not placing a vote in the national election. And it's a rather interesting idea. Like you were saying earlier, Dave, you want to vote none of the above, and that's exactly what this is.
Right.
And the way he proposes this, I can sort of envision the buzz that might happen in the media if there is a groundswell of people anticipating to pick none of the above or not pick, how that might actually gain some traction if this does become widely reported. What do you guys think?
Well, all right. Well, I'm not really a happy camper with politics and with the candidates that I've seen, not just in this upcoming election, but in the past couple of elections. And I certainly would tend to agree with at least several of these members that posted on this thread. One in particular, and I believe his name was Republic or the Republic or something like that. I think he said that he was going to abstain in 2008, and he has his own slogan, which was "Election 2008, vote with your middle finger."
Yeah, I love that one.
Yes.
Well, you know, I mean, here's the deal, you know, and I did have a chance to go to the site, Bill, and read a lot of the things that were posted, and you know, of course, Now, just to correct you one minor bit, we did talk to Jesse about that.
Oh, I don't remember hearing that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we did talk to Jesse about that, and you know, and he was, of course, he was very much pro-independent candidate, obviously, because he was an independent candidate in Minnesota. But he definitely made the comments about, you know, abstaining and, you know, none of the above. Because we had, Johnny and I both had talked about, you know, what about there was the none of the above thing. So he jumped right on. But here's the thing that struck me when I'm looking at this thing, because I immediately would have jumped on board and would have abstained, and I have abstained for numerous elections dating back more years than I care to admit, simply because I think politics is a sham, and you know, it's never going to be what everybody wants it to be. But the downside to taking this abstention scenario is that you leave everybody's future in the hands of very few people. And the people that are voting are the people that want you to stay home. They don't want you to participate in the process. They don't want you to channel the country in a direction that maybe they don't particularly care for. They want you to sit there and shoot them the finger and abstain, because that makes them a winner again, and then it becomes the same old, which is what we've had for years. Now, to me, you know, I don't think McCain or Obama, I don't think the typical Democratic and Republican parties have ever shown me anything that gives me hope for the major parties to do what they say they're going to do. Not one group has done it yet, and if it happens before I die, I'll be real surprised.
I liked Dennis Kucinich. I thought he was decent.
Yeah, I like Dennis.
He didn't stand a chance.
And I really liked
him. I know that. I know. But, I mean, as far as talking about potential candidates that were running at one time.
Yeah, right. But those guys are never going to get, they're never going to get elected, John, because nobody's going to sit there and support them.
Well, yeah, they're never going to get to the point
where... That's not where the money's at.
Yeah, they're never going to get to the point where they're a choice. And someone like that will never get to the point where you have the option of choosing him in November.
That's exactly right.
And here's the paragraph I was looking for in this opening post. He says here, "We need not itemize the need for revolution. This website and thousands more like it are testament to the diseased government allowed to fester from the apathy deviously contrived from the lack of choices presented to the people. With the power of media and the internet in our grasp, we finally have the ability to say no more." And I think what he's proposing here is that if there is enough obvious people abstaining, going to the polls but still not voting for president or national, that will spark something that is a revolution in our government. I don't think he's anticipating people stay home, for people to possibly even flood the polls, for more people showing up at the polls than in history, but such a low vote count that it's clear most of the people showing up have not voted for the president, and they want something else. And I think that's the goal of his intention here for something that could become a movement, if you will.
Yeah. I wish there would be somebody that would start a movement to change the way our election process is in the onset, which is, I don't think it should just boil down to two guys. I think the table should be left open from start to finish, and
well,
then you vote your heart and conscience.
Right. And the 2 years, literally the 2 year process.
Now, what I would love to see, and I have advocated ever since I started in the political process, is if it was a popular vote system, Bill and Johnny, I guarantee you Dennis Kucinich could have a chance. Ron Paul could have a chance. But as long as you have it in the system that it is, there is no way you are ever going to have an independent for President of the United States. It's not going to happen unless there's ever an independent vote.
No, and I agree. And, you know, technically speaking, you know, every November, we do have many more than two choices in most states. However, the problem is that you only ever hear of two.
But, Bill, the difference is that if it was a popular vote system, I would get back involved with the voting process if I felt like my vote was going to count. You know, and it wasn't up to a stupid superdelegate. And I'm telling you, if we ever got to a popular vote, you would have a hell of a lot more people voting than you will ever under the present system. Because people don't think your vote's going to count. That's the reason why we have such apathy in the voting process.
No, completely agree. I just don't know. there would be another way found to control the way the votes are cast and the way people perceive the vote. I mean, that's popular or not. I mean, we're long. That's I think that's the nature for this abstain goal that's being presented here. And I sort of agree with it. I see lots of other problems, like you guys are saying, but it's more a call for much more significant change than just that. Yeah. And I think that's what's needed, really.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I agree.
We're real close to being out of time here. Before we go, though, Bill, I wanted to ask you, the last time you were on with Dave and I, we were talking about a thread that a moderator by the name of Nefermore had created, and I was just curious. you did not get a chance to hear last week's show, but I'm just curious if you'd heard the huddlebutt about what happened.
She's a he.
That would be correct.
Yeah.
And boy, did Dave and I get a lot of grief over that.
I'll bet. Well, I'm glad you guys got the grief, and not me, because I...
That was great.
So anyway, Dave and I have publicly apologized, and I just thought, since it was the three of us, maybe you'd like to make it unanimous.
Do I? Yes, I'm sorry. That was, really, I did, I should know better, I should know my staff better, but I screwed it up.
Anyway, Bill, we appreciate the time that you take out to do these segments with us, and we'll
I
be
know
talking-
you do.
And we'll be talking to you next week, right?
Yes, certainly. Most
yeah, if the creek doesn't rise.
Yeah.
All right, Bill. We really appreciate it, brother. Thanks, man.
All right, good night.
A-T-S Mix featured interview.
Well, today is a red letter day, Dave Rabbit.
Yeah, it really is. And it's red letter for a lot of reasons. But number one, to me, is we've been doing this gig, John, for over a year now. And there has never in the history of the ATS Mix show been a guest that has been more anticipated or more participated as far as members of the AboveTopSecret.com network asking a guest a question. It's just been amazing, John.
It absolutely has. In fact, as you know, even prior to us getting the show off the road, when we were asked what kind of guests we wanted to have on the program, my first guess that I said was I would love to have Dr. Mitsuyu Kaku. And fortunately, we have been able to do just that. So let me give you a little bit of bio about our guest we'll be interviewing. And I'm going to apologize right now because I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce a lot of words in today's interview. Dr. Mitsuyu Kaku is an internationally recognized authority in theoretical physics and the environment. He holds the Henry Semmett Professorship in Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He has lectured around the world and has a PhD level in textbooks, which are required reading at many of the top physics laboratories. Dr. Kaku has graduated from Harvard back in the year 1968, summa cum laude, and the number one in his physics class. He received his PhD from the University of California at Berkeley Radiation Laboratory in 1972. He held a lectureship at Princeton University in 1973. He joined the faculty at the City University of New York, where he has been a professor of theoretical physics for 25 years. His goal is to help complete Einstein's dream of theory of everything, a single equation, perhaps no more than 1 inch long, which will unify all the fundamental forces in the universe. He has appeared in numerous TV programs and is probably best known for his part in the movie What the Bleep Do We Know? Some of the books that he's authored include Physics of the Impossible, Parallel Worlds, Hyperspace, Visions, and Einstein's Cosmos. His website is located at www.mkaku.org. That's mkaku.org. It's an honor for all of us here at AboveTopSecret.com to have joining us on the ATS Mix, Dr. Mitsuyu Kaku. Hello, Doctor. How are you?
Very good. Well, after such a great introduction, I can't wait to hear the speaker myself.
That was probably about the best it gets right there. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, it all goes downhill from here, Doctor. Well, you know, I mean, there's so many things that, as I said before, and I wasn't even exaggerating, you are absolutely the most anticipated guest of anybody that we've ever had. And, I mean, we've had some serious contenders, but none has brought the interest that you have, Doctor. I mean, it's just overwhelming.
Well, I'm glad to be on your show and hopefully meet the expectations.
All right, well, let's get to it. you know, Doctor, you're renowned in the world of physics. So, what got you interested in physics, and how old were you when you started in the physics, quest?
Well, when I was a child of 8, I still remember that all my teachers were talking in hushed tones that a great scientist had just died. Very few people understood what he had done, but everyone realized he changed everything around us. And on the evening news that night, all the newspapers flashed a picture of his desk with the unfinished manuscript of his greatest unfinished work. Well, that man was Albert Einstein. And I wanted to know what was in that book. What could be so great that the greatest scientists of our age could not finish it? Well, I said to myself, I'm going to make one of my life's missions to finish that manuscript. But everywhere I went, I could not find any clue as to what Einstein was trying to do. Now we realize that it was, in fact, his unified field theory, an equation no more than 1 inch long, which would allow us to, quote, read the mind of God. That was Einstein's dream.
So as a kid, I guess it's safe to say that you weren't one of those that that blew up the parents' garage or anything like that.
Right? Well, actually, I was. When I was in high school, I wanted to be part of this revolution, so I asked my mom one day permission to build an atom smasher in the garage. I asked for permission to build a 2.3 million electron volt Betatron electron accelerator in the garage.
Wow.
My mom said, sure, why not? And so I went to Westinghouse. I got 400 pounds of transformer steel, 22 miles of copper wire, which we wound on the high school football field. And when it was finally ready, the magnets were so powerful it could pull the fillings right out of your teeth if you got too close to my machine. When I finally plugged it in, it made this huge crackling sound as I blew out every single fuse in the house. It consumed 6 kilowatts of power. Every time the lights went blinking, my poor mom would say to herself, why can't I have a son who plays baseball? Maybe if I buy him a basketball. And for God's sake, why can't he find a nice Japanese girl? I mean, what's wrong with him? He's building these machines in the garage. Well, because of that atom smasher, I went to the National Science Fair. And there I met a man who actually helped to shape my career. He made it possible for me to get a scholarship to Harvard. He knew exactly what I was doing experiments on antimatter, which is what I was doing in high school. His name was Edward Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb.
Oh, yes.
And
wow.
He paved the way for me to get a scholarship to Harvard. And afterwards, of course, he wanted me to work on nuclear weapons. That's what he was good at. And he offered me a job, in fact, designing hydrogen warheads. I turned him down because I wanted to work on something even bigger than a hydrogen bomb. I wanted to work on the Big Bang, the creation of the universe itself. In other words, to complete Einstein's dream of a theory of everything.
Right. You were talking about Edward Teller. I know that there has been several stories and articles floating around that he was also experimenting, working with anti-gravity, or at least in trying to produce the realities of anti-gravity. I have to ask this question, and this is kind of mirrored by one of our members by the name of Ad Astra, who asked a question. But I'm sorry, Ad Astra, I'm going to beat you to the punch and ask this question. Do you think, Doctor, that there are some institutions that know about or are privy to practical applications, and maybe even more so about the fabric of physical reality and the ways of manipulating it more so than, say, the average physicist?
Well, we would all like to believe that somewhere behind closed doors, there's some kind of secret laboratory opening up huge breakthroughs at the frontiers of science that'll make star travel possible, that'll make anti-gravity possible, and so on and so forth. However, the reality is more mundane. And that is, we scientists are making painfully slow but substantial progress on unlocking the secret of matter. For example, in just a few more weeks now, the largest machine of science ever built will be turned on. It is the Large Hadron Collider. It is 17 miles in circumference. It's so big that you can put the city of Geneva inside the machine, in fact. And we hope to test the periphery of string theory with that machine, that colossal machine. Some people think, by the way, that the Large Hadron Collider could open up a hole in space, could create a black hole that'll eat up the entire Earth. However, a simple back-of-the-envelope calculation shows that even the Large Hadron Collider is a pea shooter compared to what Mother Nature can create in terms of radiation from the center of a real black hole. So I'm going to sleep soundly when they turn on the Large Hadron Collider in just a few weeks now in August.
Well, you know, you mentioned Collider, Doctor. I've got to ask you, you know, they started a super collider project down here in Texas, and it lost its funding somewhere along the way. But, boy, I remember having some friends that were involved in that project and got a chance to, when they were in the construction phase of the thing, actually see some of the tunneling that they were doing. That thing was absolutely humongous.
That's right. The Congress gave us $1 billion to dig the hole, much bigger than the European machine. But then Congress canceled it in 1993 and gave us a second $1 billion to fill up the hole. That's $2 billion to dig a hole and fill it up. I can't think of anything more stupid than that.
Oh, yeah.
However,
and you know, I'm surprised, Doctor, that the scientists, the scientific community, you know, yourself and your other esteemed colleagues, could not convince these knuckleheads that they were better off completing the thing than to spend the money to fill the hole up.
Yes. However, on the last day of hearing, the very last day of hearing, one congressman asked a physicist, he said, quote, "Will we find God with this machine? If so, I will change my vote and vote for it." Well, the poor physicist was supposed to ask this $10 billion question. And he simply said, "We're going to find the Higgs boson with this machine." The jaws hit the floor because people said $10 billion for another god darn subatomic particle. And the vote was taken, and they canceled the machine. Now, since then, we physicists have replayed that moment over and over and over in our mind. How should we have answered that question, will we find God with this machine? Now, I would have answered it differently. I would have said, God, by whatever signs or symbols you ascribe to the deity, this machine will take us as close as humanly possible to his greatest creation, Genesis. This is a Genesis machine. The purpose of this machine is to create a piece of the cataclysmic energy that gave birth to the universe itself. However, instead, the poor physicist said Higgs boson, and they canceled the machine.
I bet you guys don't make that mistake again.
We hope not. But like I said, we hope to create something in that machine called dark matter. It's the most mysterious substance known to science. It is invisible, but it has weight. And we hope that by creating dark matter, we'll find out what the universe is really made out of. The universe we thought was made out of atoms, right? Every textbook says that. But we now know that's wrong. Most of the universe is not made out of atoms. Most of the universe is made out of dark matter and dark energy. And dark matter could be a higher vibration of the superstring, a higher octave of the superstring, so to speak.
Well, we have a number of members at AboveTopSecret.com that submitted all these great questions, and like I said, I'm going to apologize now because I probably will mispronounce a lot of the words that they used here. Starting off with JPM1602, this member's question is, what is your take on PHI and the nature of the universe? It seems PHI is everywhere, from galaxies to genetic material.
You mean some kind of psi force?
Is that what they're trying to refer to? Psi, possibly?
Possibly. Yeah. Well, let me explain. There are four fundamental forces which make up the universe. There is gravity, which keeps us on the floor. There's the electromagnetic force, which lights up the cities and is responsible for light. Then there's the weak and the strong nuclear force that's responsible for hydrogen bombs, the stars. It's what lights up the galaxy. These are the four fundamental forces. Now, some people have claimed that maybe there's a fifth force, a psi force, P-S-I force,
okay,
which could be responsible for the paranormal, perhaps things that allow for telepathy and telekinesis are linked to the psi force. Well, we physicists have looked for the psi force. So far, we see no evidence of it. However, we do believe that it may be possible to have telepathy and psychokinesis without having to resort to anything paranormal. For example, at Brown University just about 3 years ago, they took a stroke victim who is partially paralyzed, put electrodes in the top of his brain, connected the electrodes to a laptop. In a few hours, he was moving the cursor on the laptop screen, and now he can read email. He can answer emails. He can play video games. He can do crossword puzzles just by thinking about it because he's paralyzed. So we will have a form of telepathy, I think, in the near future by using computers to interface directly with the human brain.
Wow, that's amazing.
Wow. Yeah, that is amazing. Okay, Doctor, as Johnny had said, the members are pretty astute here at AboveTopSecret.com, and some of them in their questions, there may be like three sentences before they finally get the full question out. So if you'll bear with us, a few of these members, we're going to read their question as written. And then if we need to restate something or whatever, we'll be happy to do that.
Okay.
This first example is late Apexer 313. Doctor, there was an episode of the universe about theoretical particles called tachyons that can move faster than the speed of light, and some theorizing that there might be a way to somehow harness, piggyback a ride, or figure out a way to overcome the problem of mass increasing as the speed of light is surpassed, so that a craft carrying people could theoretically travel. Could you please explain further about tachyons and this particular theory?
Okay, tachyons are a theorized form of matter that naturally travel faster than the speed of light. As they lose energy, they get faster and faster and faster, believe it or not, so that a tachyon with zero energy has infinite velocity. Now, if you could ride on a tachyon, it'd be quite neat, because you could break the light barrier and go pretty much anywhere in the universe that you wanted. However, we've looked very carefully for the presence of tachyons, and so far we find no evidence of any tachyons in our universe. However, the leading theory of the Big Bang today, something that is called inflationary theory, which was proposed by my colleague, Alan Guth at MIT, who may eventually win the Nobel Prize for that theory. Inflation theory is based on the idea that there was some kind of rip in time, some kind of disturbance in the fabric of space and time, and the leading way in which we create this tiny disturbance in space and time is with a tachyon. So believe it or not, the standard model of cosmology uses tachyons which destabilize the vacuum, create a hole in space, which then expands very rapidly to create our universe. So maybe that's the reason why we don't see tachyons, because they have all pretty much initiate an explosion like a fuse being lit. The tachyon is the spark that lights the fuse, which then sets off the entire universe. So after the universe has exploded, there are no more tachyons left.
Ah.
So that may explain that. So we actually use tachyons in standard cosmology. And inflationary theory, by the way, seems to fit all the data coming in from our WMAP satellite currently orbiting the Earth. And it does give you the best description of the expanding universe. So we don't find evidence of tachyons today. If we did, we could then go to the nearest galaxy overnight. However, we do believe that perhaps what tachyons really did was to create a rip in space, which then became our universe, including
right.
you and me.
Wow. Well, Dave, I just learned something.
Well, good, John.
since you're the
science guy of the teamwork here, you know.
From Israel, member Zero Knowledge asks this. Doctor, I'd like to ask you, what is your opinion on the possibility of moving material objects in time, in the past or future of the observer?
Well, it used to be that time travel was considered the province of crackpots. We don't think that anymore, by the way. Now there are very serious papers written by my friends looking into the possibility of one day meeting ourselves, as children and meeting our parents before we're born. Now it turns out that as early as 1949, Einstein's colleague at Princeton, Kurt Gödel, one of the greatest mathematical logicians of the past 1,000 years, showed that if the universe was spinning, you would have time travel. If the universe were spinning and you traveled around the universe, you would come back before you left. So if you left in the year 2000, you can come back in the year 1900. And, well, we know that the universe doesn't rotate. It expands. It doesn't rotate, which means that if the universe did rotate, then time travel would be very common. Then after that, scientists showed that if I had a long maypole that was spinning and you danced around the maypole, if the maypole was spinning fast enough, then you would actually go backwards in time and again come back before you left. The most standard way to build a time machine is with a black hole. If a black hole is spinning very rapidly, it does not collapse to a dot. That's the old picture. The new picture is that every time we see black holes in space, and we see thousands of them, they are spinning very rapidly. And a spinning black hole collapses to a ring, not a dot, a ring. And if you fall through the ring, you don't fall through a gravitational field and die. You fall through the looking glass of Alice to another universe. So think of Alice's looking glass. The rim of the looking glass is the black hole. The rim of the looking glass is the black hole. And by going through the ring, you can essentially go to a parallel universe. This is called the Kerr black hole, and it is a mathematical realization of Alice's looking glass. Because right. Alice in Wonderland was actually written by a mathematician, an Oxford mathematician by the name of Charles Dodgson, who wrote under the pen name of Lewis Carroll. And in fact, when Charles Dodgson wrote Alice in Wonderland, Queen Victoria was so enchanted that he wrote him a letter saying, please, please, give me your next book, which he did. It was a treatise on higher mathematics that he sent to Queen Victoria. So The point is that maybe, just perhaps, at the center of a black hole, there could be a gateway to another point in space and time.
Okay, Doctor, the next member is called For Manator. And his comment is, Doctor, I watched What the Bleep Do We Know, was fascinated by the concept of quantum entanglement. I am not clear exactly what the repercussions mean exactly, but it is fair to say that subatomic particles are not governed by space and time. Is it only the atom that is affected by time?
Well, quantum entanglement goes to the very heart of reality. We think that particles exist in isolated forms, so that an electron here does not interact so much with an electron 10 miles away. But there is a cosmic web that connects all matter together, because all matter was, of course, connected at the instant of the Big Bang. But when two objects vibrate in unison, and then you separate them, there is an invisible umbilical cord that connects them, so that if you jiggle one particle, then the other particle senses it, even though it's on the other side of the universe. Now, Einstein, to be frank, hated this idea, because it meant that, in some sense, something went faster than the speed of light. If you have two electrons that are entangled and you jiggle one, then on the other side of the universe, another object senses that jiggling. Well, we've measured this effect. The ultimate arbiter is, of course, experiment, and by golly, Einstein was wrong. We do see quantum entanglement, and so the quantum theory is correct. Einstein, of course, had doubts about the quantum theory, but we measure the quantum theory every day. In fact, the quantum theory makes possible the transistor, the laser, the internet, your flat screen TV, your iPod. All of it is made possible by the quantum theory, okay? Now, one application of quantum entanglement is teleportation. I mentioned this in my book, Physics of the Impossible. If you have objects that vibrate in unison, then it may be possible to use that effect to zap an object from one place to another. Now, so far, we've already done that at the atomic scale. About 10 years ago, the first photon was zapped from one place to another. The world's record, by the way, is about 100 miles. We've zapped photons about 100 miles from one Canary Island to another. The next goal is to shoot particles into outer space using teleportation. We're going to ask NASA for permission to use a space shuttle. And we want to zap a subatomic particle from the Earth all the way to outer space, and maybe even eventually to the moon after 2020. Now, this is not quite like on Star Trek, where Captain Kirk dissolves and then reappears someplace else. We've only done this on the atomic scale so far. We haven't done Captain Kirk. That would be quite difficult to get an entire human being to be teleported. But one application of quantum entanglement is teleportation. Another application is quantum computers. Eventually, silicon power that we use on our desktop will be exhausted. Moore's law and silicon power will go the way of the Rust Belt, and we're going to have to compute on atoms. So quantum entanglement could, in fact, be the basis of the world economy in 20, 50 years.
You think we'll be around to see that happen?
Well, we are making vast inroads on the question of aging. We've isolated about 50 genes so far that seem to be influencing the aging process. We've even isolated some genes, the sirtuin genes, that seem to slow down the aging process, at least in animals. We can double the lifespan of most animals now, by the way, everything from a spider to yeast cells to insects, to dogs, cats. We're now experimenting on primates. We can double the lifespan by something called caloric restriction, which means essentially starving yourself. But using the sirtuin genes, we may be able to get the benefits of caloric restriction without having to live like a hermit. So it's conceivable that in the coming years, yeah, we will isolate the genes that control the aging process.
It'll be my luck, John, that I'll be laying on the bed, and Father McGillicuddy will be coming in there giving me my last rites, and somebody will rush in and go, "Hey, the doctor's figured out how to give longevity."
Yeah,
and then all of a sudden you see this flat line going on.
Yeah. Well, one thing we can do today is to grow replacement organs for your own body from your own cells. We can grow skin, bone, cartilage, noses, ears, even bladders now by taking your cells, putting it in a petri dish, and growing it into a mold. The next organ to be grown in the laboratory is the liver. And that could create a huge stampede of patients because a lot of people die waiting for replacement livers.
Liver transplants, yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Mickey Mantle, the great Yankee star, died because of liver failure.
Yep, sure it is. Yep.
And so we'll be able to grow another liver perhaps within 5 years.
Wow.
So this is coming very soon, a human body shock. They take cells from your body, put it in a mold. The mold dissolves like plastic, biodegradable plastic, leaving a perfect bladder. That's the world's record so far for a human organ. But the same laboratory in North Carolina that grew the bladder is now working on a liver. I visited the laboratory. I hosted a BBC Science special, which will air on the Science Channel in August, on August 10th, where I actually show how we will function in the future, including creating a human body shop, just like an automobile body shop.
It boggles my mind, but John, I gotta ask this, Doctor. Do you foresee that you and the scientific community are gonna get hammered by all the naysayers or the do-gooders that are gonna sit there and hound you guys to death, saying, "Oh, well, you're tampering with the will of God and all that stuff," or you think it's a way to do it to where you're not gonna have all these people hammering you guys all the time?
Well, look at it this way. When Louise Brown, the first test tube baby, was born a few decades ago, the Pope himself denounced this technology as immoral, creating test tube babies. But now, you know, your best friend may be a test tube baby. Your wife may be a test tube baby. This technology was so revolutionary that the first idea that occurred to people's mind was, how can I get it? How can I get it? People will want this technology so bad to be able to lengthen the lifespan, to be able to replace organs as they wear out. People will want this technology so bad, the demand will be so great that all the religious chatter will be forgotten, just like the test tube baby is now a fact of life.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask this. I read an article, I think it was in the past 6 months, where the government has approved to be able to sell over-the-counter now cloned meat without stipulating that it is cloned meat. What are your thoughts on this, and do you think there's any health worries that we should be concerned about?
Well, what I'm a little worried about is the fact that when you clone an animal, you do violence to the genome. When you actually take a cloned animal and sequence it, that is, take all the genes and analyze them one for one, you find a lot of hidden mutations in the genome that is not visible in the animal because they are recessive genes rather than dominant genes.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit fearful of the fact that as we allow healthy-looking animals to go into the food supply, that there could be some hidden recessive genes that are also sent into the gene pool that we're not aware of. But however, at the present time, you know, cloned meat, people are not going to buy it because it's so experimental. But I think cloning will eventually become a fact of life. In fact, one day, even though nations may try to ban it, there will be a demand for cloning. Rich people, for example, with no heirs or no heirs they particularly care for, may decide to clone themselves and give their money to themselves as children.
Wow, now there's a concept.
All over again.
That's
now,
a concept.
See, I love that. I love that. You hit the nail on the head, doctor. I think that's exactly what I want to do because I have exactly that need right now in my own personal life.
And doing it that way on a parts level, I would see that how that might actually avoid confrontation with the does a clone have a soul factor.
Yeah, I think the clone having a soul is going to be pretty much a moot issue because, like I said, there will be clones, but there'll probably be illegal clones or clones done in secret because there will be laws passed against human cloning. But how do you stop a laboratory in Hong Kong from offering rich people secret clones? How do you stop that?
Right.
It only takes about
$10,000 to $20,000
to start up a laboratory, and you're in business. So it's like drugs. You can ban it, you can regulate it, but you can't eliminate it totally. We'll just have to live with it.
Right.
Yeah, and it's pretty much the same concept as the cryogenics thing with Disney's head on ice.
Yeah, except there's a problem there. When you take human tissue and you freeze it, like in science fiction movies, when you go to the stars, ice crystals form, and ice crystals shatter the cell wall, creating mush and destroying tissue. Now, we know how fish do it. Fish and frogs can be frozen alive in a block of ice and then thawed out in the next season because frogs have antifreeze. It turns out that glucose, sugar, can be used as an antifreeze to change the freezing point of water. So outside the frog, you have solid ice, but inside the frog, it's still liquid because of glucose.
Wow.
However, the human body would have to be genetically modified to withstand that much glucose or antifreeze in our blood. So the human body right now cannot be frozen and then thawed out and then to create a healthy individual again. So all those people that are paying to have their bodies frozen, I think their descendants are going to be shocked when they thaw them out.
Right.
Well, Walt's not going to be a very happy camper then.
A member by the name of Pelle Vossen, I believe that's how this member pronounced their name, asked this, and bear with me, it gets a little lengthy. Are there infinite quantum state variations on our reality? If I exist in a reality with this quantum signature, would I also exist in realities with different quantum signatures? Should one be able to communicate with one's other self with their different quantum signatures, but in some sense, still strung together with oneself?
Okay, well, it turns out that even Nobel laureates in physics yell and scream at each other when we talk about parallel universes. It turns out that the growing opinion among most physicists is that there are parallel universes. We call this the multiverse. And that, you know, just like Hugh Everett predicted back in the 1950s, whenever a quantum decision has to be made, the universe splits into two universes, which means that if a cosmic ray went through Hitler's mother, a tiny quantum event, a cosmic ray, could actually have created a miscarriage, in which case, in that universe, Hitler was never born, and in which case, 40 million people didn't have to die during World War II.
Right.
Or if a cosmic ray went through Roosevelt's mother, perhaps we're speaking German today. And in fact, there's a Nazi flag behind your office. So one tiny quantum event, we think, can in fact separate entire universes. However, communicating between these universes is quite difficult. The analogy we use is as follows. In your living room, you know that there are many radio frequencies in your room. Your radio is tuned into, I don't know, ABC radio or whatever, but there's also Radio Moscow, there's also BBC radio in your room. But your radio is only tuned to one frequency. Well, your room is also vibrating. There's a wave that guides the vibration of your universe. There's also the wave of dinosaurs. There's also the wave of pirates and space aliens right in your living room. In your living room, in your office, there is the wave function of pirates, dinosaurs, aliens that coexist with us, but we're not tuned to them anymore. Your radio is not tuned to Radio Moscow. It could receive it, but it's not tuned to it. It's not coherent to it. We call this decoherence. We have decohered from Radio Moscow in the same way that our wave function has decohered from the wave function of dinosaurs. That's why you don't see dinosaurs trampling through your room. Because of the fact that we are no longer vibrating in unison. We're not tuned to that frequency anymore. Right. Now, believe it or not, this is now the standard picture of the universe that we teach our students. It's called the multiverse. It's gotten quite a bit of interest because of string theory. String theory seems to lead toward a multiverse, in which case our universe could be one among many universes.
Wow. All right. So, AboveTopSecret.com member Bobo Fett asked, Doctor, you have explained in the past that the universe is expanding continually and will eventually end in ice as everything gets so far apart. I understand that when some materials get to these temperatures, close to absolute zero, they become superconductors. Will this have any effect on the expansion?
Probably not, but let me explain why. As the person mentioned, it is correct. All the data seems to indicate that the universe is expanding, and it's accelerating, and it's careening out of control. The universe seems to be in a runaway mode. It's going to keep on expanding until temperatures reach near absolute zero, and this is a death warrant for all intelligent life. It means that all intelligent life will eventually freeze to death billions and billions of years from now. When the universe expands so rapidly, the night sky will be dark, totally dark. The Earth will be totally frozen over, if there is an Earth, and it's rather depressing thinking about that. Now, it also turns out that matter becomes superconducting at low temperatures. But at these distant times, even the atoms themselves have crumbled into nothingness. So even if there are superconductors, it doesn't help because even the atoms will have decayed into electrons and the universe will be a gas of electrons. Now this may sound depressing, however, there's one and only one way to avoid such a death, and that is to leave the universe. String theory does give us the option of perhaps drilling a hole in space-time one day. We don't know for sure, but the equations seem to indicate that we can do this. In which case, we may want to leave the universe. We may want to go to another universe which is warmer and perhaps start all over again. So we don't necessarily have to die when the universe dies. So as I tell my friends, it's okay to wake up tomorrow morning. It's okay to, you know, take your driver's license test, take your exam, get your degree. You don't have to be depressed about it because there is hope. In the far future, we may leave the universe.
Well, you know what's interesting about that, John, forgive me for jumping in front of you, but what's interesting about what you said about that is, you know, there's so many theories, and of course we have a huge belief on AboveTopSecret.com. There's a huge influx of members that obviously believe in UFOs and aliens and intelligent beings from other planets and whatever. And in the statement where you said we may not be able to tolerate what's coming up, you know, a billion years from now or whatever, and we have to seek other planets. Well, you know, I got a shudder down my spine because that's exactly what a lot of people profess, you know, that we're being visited by people that may in their own galaxies or their own planets be faced with the same scenario that you're just talking about.
Yeah, well, when you talk about, you know, intelligent life in outer space, I do think that they are out there. The difference is that we physicists try to rank them according to energy consumption. We rank them in terms of type 1, type 2, and type 3. A type 1 civilization, for example, has harnessed completely the power of their planet. They can control hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, volcanoes. They're a planetary civilization. Eventually, they exhaust the power of a planet, and they go to their sun. They just don't get a suntan. They play with stars. They put stars in their gas tank and energize their starships by gobbling up white dwarf stars. That's type 2. And an example of a type 2 civilization would be Star Trek. The Federation of Planets is a typical type 2 civilization. Then we have type 3, which is galactic. which consumes the energy of an entire galaxy, and the Empire of the Empire Strikes Back, or the Borg of Star Trek, or Independence Day, all of them would represent galactic civilizations. And then maybe there's even the possibility of Type 4, the power of a god, the power to go beyond the galaxy.
Wow.
That would be the Q of Star Trek, controlling the power of the continuum. Their energy source is not planets, stars, or galaxies. Their energy source is dark energy, the continuum. That would be the Q. Now, on this scale, what are we? Do we control the weather?
Yeah, that was my question. Are we zero?
We are type zero. We get our energy from dead plants, oil, and coal. However, we are about 100 years away from becoming type one.
Really?
Wow.
For example, every time I read the newspaper, I see the birth pangs of type one. Like, what is the internet? The internet is a type one telephone system being born right before our eyes. The first type one telephone system being born. That's the internet. The language of type one will be English. It's already the universal language of mathematics, science, medicine, government, and the arts. Eventually, not just the elites, but the middle class will speak English around the world. The European Union is an example of the birth of a type one economy, as we have huge trade blocks being developed around the world. And also, there's a type one culture being born. Rock and roll, blue jeans, rap music, Hollywood movies, all of them represent the emergence of a planetary culture that's being formed. And we also have a planetary backlash. We even have people who don't like the transition to type one. They can't articulate it this way. These are the terrorists. Terrorism is basically a backlash against the creation of a type one civilization, which is, by definition, scientific, multicultural, and progressive. And that's exactly what terrorists do not like. So every time I open the newspaper, I see the birth pangs of a type one civilization. So we're privileged to be alive to witness the greatest transition in the history of the human race, the transition from type zero to type one.
Wow.
Wow.
But that transition is not guaranteed, of course. Maybe that's why we don't see aliens visiting us every day, because maybe they didn't make the transition. Because with the coming of the internet, with the coming of the European Union, with the coming of the planetary language, we also have the coming of nuclear weapons and the coming of terrorism and the coming of designer germ warfare. So it's not guaranteed that we will make it to type one, but there are, you know, two forces in the world today. One force is the force toward a planetary civilization that's progressive and scientific and multicultural. The second force is toward chaos, anarchy, and terrorism.
That's something to mull over. Project Firefly, I want to apologize. Your question was already answered, but it kind of ties in with an anonymous ATS guest who asked this question. If through the use of highly advanced accelerators, like the Large Collider that is going to be going online here shortly, we are able to create tiny black holes. Would it be possible to fire a brief laser communique into them, into the future, and receive them back now in the past, providing us with a knowledge of events that have yet to occur?
Well, yes and no. It turns out that these black holes that may be created by the Large Hadron Collider, which opens up in just a few weeks now, these black holes are subatomic. They only last very briefly. They're not dangerous. In fact, you could barely light up a light bulb with the energy of these mini black holes. You would even have the power of a cockroach if you add up all the energy of these mini black holes. But they're very tiny. Laser light, however, has a wavelength. The wavelength of laser light is too big. So light cannot fit. Light, in some sense, is too big to fit into one of these microscopic black holes. But it's a rather ingenious idea that this person is proposing, because in principle, black holes could be gateways to another universe. There are, of course, people who don't believe that, but, you know, the equations seem to indicate that a black hole could be a gateway to another universe. And this gentleman proposes then shooting laser light through a black hole, through the Einstein-Rosen bridge at the center of the black hole, that then connects you to a white hole, perhaps in another universe. The problem is that these are microscopic black holes, too small for laser light. But it is a rather ingenious idea that this person is proposing.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier, Doctor, about the parallel dimensions and universes. This member, Dimensional Detective, has kind of a slant on what we were talking about, and I'll go ahead and read his question. Knowing that you are big on parallel dimensions and universes, do you believe, Doctor, that we will one day have the ability to travel or enter into and out of these realities? And do you think that perhaps somewhere in this multiverse there will be some very advanced species that have already figured out how to do this?
Well, it's conceivable. Right now, of course, we don't have the energy to do that. We are type zero. However, a type three civilization, you just get a calculator and do some calculations, a type three civilization does have enough energy to access what is called the Planck energy. The Planck energy is the energy at which space and time become unstable. So if I had a microwave oven and I could heat it up to the Planck temperature, little holes would form, little bubbles would form inside your microwave oven, and these little holes would be gateways, wormholes, Einstein-Rosen bridges to other universes. So, for example, we think of our universe today as a soap bubble. We live on the skin of the soap bubble, and our soap bubble is expanding. But we now believe there are other soap bubbles out there. So we now have a bubble bath. So the paradigm for the multiverse is a bubble bath of parallel universes that are floating, bumping into each other all the time. And this gives you a different picture of Genesis. Most people realize that there are two paradigms for the creation of the universe. One is Genesis, where somebody says, let there be light, and the universe is created. But there's also Buddhism, which says that there's only Nirvana. The universe always was, always will be, and there is no beginning, there is no end. The multiverse combines these two ideas into one. Now we do have a Genesis, but it's a continual Genesis. Even as we began this radio interview, universes have been created, popping into existence all around us, and perhaps there is intelligent life, as the reader mentioned, on these other universes. Now, in my book, Parallel Worlds, I end the book on building a machine that could then go between universes. The machine would be a minimum 10 light years across. It'd be very big. It was so big it'd have to be built in outer space. Spaceships would have to build the machine connecting different solar systems. But for a Type 3 civilization, no matter how fantastic that may seem, this would be child's play for a Type 3 civilization. So it's definitely conceivable that an advanced civilization, a Type 3 civilization, already has the capability of opening up such gateways.
We're down to our last three questions here, Doctor. Forsaken Wayfarer asked this question. What is your understanding of the observer effect in the sense of whether systems have pre-existing, prior to measurement, that is, properties corresponding to all measurements that could possibly be made on them, i.e., that everything not explicitly impossible can happen, ignoring the relative probability of such an event?
Well, philosophers used to ask the question, if a tree falls in a forest and there's no one there to witness it, does a tree really fall in the forest?
Right.
Well, ever since Isaac Newton, scientists have laughed at that statement because, of course, trees exist independent of the observer. Well, now comes the quantum theory, which says, not so fast. If you do not yet look at the tree is not yet observed, then, according to the Copenhagen School, the tree exists in all possible states. That is, burnt, tinderwood, toothpicks, firewood, sapling, full-grown tree, house. It exists in all possible states. And when you look at it, it instantly turns into a tree. Now, Einstein thought that was so fantastic and so crazy that when he invited people to his house, he would say, look at the moon. Does the moon spring into existence when a mouse looks at the moon? Well, quantum theory would say yes, in some sense. This gets back to the Schrodinger cat problem, which is one of the greatest paradoxes of all time. Even today, we physicists still debate the cat problem. The cat problem is that if you put a cat in a box and are not allowed to see the box, then the cat exists in all possible states. dead and alive simultaneously.
Hmm.
When you open the box, then you know the cat is alive. But before you open the box, the cat could be dead, alive, a kitten, dissolved, sawdust, firewood, what have you, all possible states before you open the box. Now, that's crazy, right? There are two ways to resolve the paradox. If you look at most old physics textbooks, we simply say, open the box, observation determines existence. Well, Einstein hated that idea. Observation determines existence. The new theory is the multiverse, and that is the universe simply splits. There's one universe with a dead cat and another universe with a live cat, and they all exist simultaneously. The only catch is that we have decohered from them. We no longer vibrate in unison with them, so that talking to them, making contact with them, is quite difficult. But it does mean that perhaps your dead parents or dead relatives or dead friends are still alive in another universe. And they think their universe is the real one and that our universe is the fake one. They think their reality is real. That cannot be dismissed. According to the quantum theory and the multiverse, yes, in some sense, dead people are still alive.
I think I saw that movie, Night of the Living Dead.
<That's it. laughs> Well, here they would be alive in a different universe.
Yeah, they were in our universe. You know, I love that analogy about the cat in the box, because I've got several cats, and I'd be willing to try that out, Doctor, if you could maybe send me an email and tell me how to experiment with my own cats with that one.
Uh-huh.
Okay, member Avant-Garde, or Evan. Evan Mottgard. There you go. I got it right. Doctor, his question is very simple. Do you personally believe intelligent alien life has ever visited planet Earth?
Well, put it this way. If you are a Type 3 civilization on the verge of exploring the galaxy, how would you do it? You would not send Captain Kirk on the Enterprise to go planet to planet to planet. It would take millions of years for Captain Kirk to explore the galaxy. That's
right.
Stupid. The most efficient way to explore the galaxy is with self-replicating robots. These are tiny robots, perhaps no bigger than a shoebox, that land on a moon, because moons are stable with no erosion. And these shoebox-sized robots create factories where they duplicate themselves by a factor of a million. And then these robots shoot out and land on other moons, and they start all over again. So starting with one robot, you have a million. Then they fan out to create a million million. Then you have a million million million. And pretty soon you colonize the entire galaxy. That's how a virus colonizes your body. Think about it. A virus is a molecule that gives you a cold in 2 weeks. How is that possible? Because a virus lands on a cell, hijacks the machinery, and then your cell becomes a breeding ground for thousands of more viruses. Well, this is the most efficient way to explore the galaxy. Now, where have you seen this before? You've seen this before in a movie called 2001.
Right.
In the movie 2001, remember that on the moon, there is a robot that makes copies of itself. And the robot is there waiting for us to become type one, that is, to become interesting.
Right.
Now, Stanley Kubrick, when he made the movie 2001, interviewed scientists and asked them what is the best way to explore the galaxy. And we all said the same thing, self-replicating robots that land on a moon to create thousands of copies of themselves. And they wait for a civilization to become type one, and then they send a message to the home base saying, we have arrived. Well, in a fit of creativeness, Stanley Kubrick cut the first 10 minutes of his own film, and the film became super mystical. But the film, even today, is the most authentic, I think, representation of an encounter with an intelligent civilization. Think back to the movie.
Doctor, it's interesting that you say that, because the sequel, 2010, they had the replicating, what were they called, monoliths?
Right. They had it explicit. That the monoliths were replicating themselves explicitly.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's exactly how we would do it. Now, this means that perhaps on our own moon, there is a machine left over from a passing Type 3 civilization just waiting for us to become Type 1 to make contact with it, in which case we would become interesting to them. Right now, we're not very interesting to them because we're Type 0. not very, type zero civilization, it could be dime a dozen. But when we become type one, we're very interesting. We're planetary, we have planetary right. science, planetary culture. At that right. point, they may want to make contact with us.
This next question is by Spider J, and it falls along the same lines, I think, as how you answered Forsaken Wayfarer. But I'm going to go ahead and ask it, and you can either add or detract from it. Spider J says, I know that the Copenhagen collapse has fallen out of favor with most scientists, but I hope you'll indulge me. Could the Copenhagen collapse be some sort of immune system, for lack of a better term? Couldn't it be an integral part of keeping the machinery of the multiverse from overloading by its creation and distribution of new universes' realities, which could basically then be seen as an energy distribution?
Well, let me try to answer that. The Copenhagen School, that is the school of Niels Bohr, believed that there was a wall separating us from the atomic world. The atomic world is bizarre. The atomic world, electrons disappear, reappear someplace else. You could be two places at the same time in the atomic world, and that's called electronics. Modern electronics depends on the fact that electrons can be two places at the same time, disappear, and reappear someplace else. But we can't do it, says the Copenhagen School, because there's a wall separating us. Well, we look for that wall. We can't find it. In fact, now we have nanotechnology. With nanotechnology, we can actually move individual atoms. In fact, for the BBC program, they put me in front of a machine where I could move, by moving a cursor on a screen, I could move individual atoms across a computer screen. So there is no wall, okay? So the Copenhagen School, at least in my opinion, simply does not fit with reality. Now, this person says, in the multiverse point of view, we have the universe is splitting off infinitely, and he says perhaps there's going to be an overload of universes. Maybe there'll be too many universes. But you see, each universe exists in a different state. In other words, they have decohered. They're no longer vibrating in unison. So it is possible to pile infinite number of universes onto your living room and not have an overload because these universes have decohered from each other. In fact, think of your living room. How many radio frequencies are there in your living room? Well, not only can you pick up the radio frequencies from commercial radio stations, but there's also the sun, the stars, Jupiter, all of them emitting radio. How many stations are there? Maybe an infinite number of stations, and there's no overload. So you don't have to resort to an overload to eliminate the problem of a multiverse.
Believe it or not, that concludes the questions that was just on page one, and we have five other pages that we could have gone to. And we want to apologize to all our members if we did not get to your question. What we'd like to do, Doctor, if we could we ask you to possibly be able to come back and do a part two of an interview with you?
Yes, I think that's possible.
That would be wonderful. Dave, are you up to that? Did you learn anything today?
Doctor, I got to tell you, I've never been as impressed with any human being in my life as I am with you, sir.
Well, thank you.
So, Doctor, once again, we want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come join us. We want to remind all our friends and members alike, all 23 million fans, that Dr. Kaku's website is located at www.mkaku.org. That's mkaku.org. His books that are available, and they're available everywhere, include Physics of the Impossible, Parallel Worlds, Hyperspace, Visions, and Einstein's Cosmos. And we'll hope that you will go by and pick up a book or two. What is coming up in the future for you, Doctor? Is there anything that you would like to plug or promote real quick?
Well, two things. One is that Physics of the Impossible hit the New York Times bestseller list for 5 weeks running. It was the number one science book in the United States just last month. And also on the Science Channel, I'll be hosting a three-hour, three-part series about the future called Visions of the Future, starting August 10th on the Science Channel. We talk about computers of the future, medicine of the future, and nanotechnology and quantum physics of the future. And again, it's a three-hour program that I am hosting for the Science Channel.
That's fantastic. On behalf of the staff and management here at AboveTopSecret.com, and of course Dave and yours truly, Johnny Anonymous, we thank you once again, Doctor, and we look forward to our part two interview with you.
Thank you for your time, Doctor.
Okay, thank you.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll be right back.